content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to That's a Laugh. This is Jennifer Green with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. Ah, my dear listeners, we are nearing the end of the year, and the end of this year is extra special because we are just about 12 months away from that magical time in the U.S. The debates, the polls, the Electoral College, yes, indeedy, the 2020 presidential election is already underway. Potential candidates are putting in their bids for their parties, and voters will soon be making or breaking political hearts. To help us get into the election spirit, today's episode is all about presidents and politics. Sort of. Sorry, all you lovers of political pundit types. No insight into the potential candidates and their top agendas here on TAL. Today we'll hear from some of our favorite authors and comedians as they give us a history lesson on presidents, insight into women's votes, and recommendations on keeping the peace in personal relationships during the elections. First, just to show that we aren't partial here on That's a Laugh, let's start off with a nice bipartisan quote from Soapboxy.com. These words from classic comedian Bob Hope. No one party can fool all of the people all of the time. That's why we have two parties. But seriously, folks, I'm not here to tell you which party you should or shouldn't vote for. However, if you happen to be wavering on which way you should vote, then you are in luck. Sean Dietrich answers the question of which candidate we should always go with for president. His solution is simple, quite literally. From his book, Sean of the South, Whistling Dixie, published in 2016, the chapter, Vote Andy Taylor. I'm not crazy about our presidential candidates, but it's not their fault. These politicians are who they are. While I'll bet they're upstanding, God-fearing folk, I sure as shoe shine don't want them at my barbecue. Thus, I've come up with the only political idea I've ever had. You can slap me sideways once you've heard it. I suggest we elect Sheriff Andy Taylor for president. If you don't know who Andy is, you might as well quit reading here. Andy is good people. Most folks from tiny rural towns are. Furthermore, I can relate to him. He was raised in church, he finger-picks a flat top, he's good with a joke, and he believes in skipping work to go fishing on occasion. I don't care which party he's affiliated with, because I'm confident all Andy's parties have plenty of potato salad. You want his political record? Fine. Andy's been sheriff since 1960, and there's never even been one auto accident in his town. Not a one. Andy's the kind of guy who once grounded his own boy for not donating enough to the needy children's fund. Let that sink in a moment. He's an extinct breed. Andy's got big ears, talks with a drawl, and sings Southern gospel like your granddaddy, and he'll sing you whichever hymn you please. He knows the entire Baptist hymnal by heart. The best thing about Andy is that he doesn't campaign. In fact, he doesn't give a damn who you vote for. He's a simple man, not a self-promoter passing out flyers. He'd rather be catching a smallmouth bass on a cane pole. And frankly, so would I. In the only debate speech I ever heard him deliver, he said, "You're either satisfied with me, or you're not. And, I guess we'll find out when you vote." Good old Andy. The world could do with more of him. Some of his trademarks, like kindness, charity, and trust, are more common among house cats than politicians. The truth is, I think politics is a very sick game played with our money. That's why I'm voting for Andy. Because, to tell you the truth, I'm gullible enough to believe he is still out there. Somewhere. Not convinced Andy Taylor would make that good of a president? Maybe you need a refresher on what some of the U.S.'s more notable presidents have accomplished? Not to worry. Bill Bryson gives a history of why we had not one, but two whole holidays in honor of U.S. presidents. From his book, I'm a Stranger Here Myself, published in 2008, the chapter, Hail to the Chief. It's President's Day tomorrow. I know, I can hardly stand the excitement either. President's Day is a new holiday to me. When I was growing up, we had two presidential holidays in February, Lincoln's birthday on February 12th and Washington's birthday on February 22nd. I may not be exactly right on those dates, or indeed even very close, because frankly it's been a long time since I was growing up, and anyway, they weren't very interesting holidays. You didn't receive presents or get to go on a picnic or anything. The obvious shortcoming with having a holiday on a date like February 12th or February 22nd is that it can fall on any day of the week, whereas most people like to have their public holidays on Mondays, which gives them a long weekend. So for a while, America celebrated Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday on the Mondays nearest the appropriate dates. However, this bothered some people of a particular nature, so it was decided to have a single holiday on the third Monday of February and call it President's Day. The idea now is to honor all the presidents, whether they were good or bad, which I think is swell because it gives us an opportunity to commemorate the more obscure or peculiar presidents, people like Grover Cleveland, who reportedly had the interesting habit of relieving himself out of the Oval Office window, or Zachary Taylor, who never voted in an election and didn't even vote for himself. As everyone knows, America has produced quite a few great presidents, Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, Franklin and Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, John F. Kennedy. More interestingly, it has also produced several great men who incidentally became president, among them James Madison, Ulysses S. Grant, and, you may be surprised to hear me say this, Herbert Hoover. I have a certain regard for Hoover. Fondness would be much too strong a word, because he was from Iowa, and so am I. Besides, you have to feel a little sorry for the poor man. He was the only person in American history for whom attaining the White House was a retrograde career move. Nowadays, when people think of Hoover at all, it is as the man who gave the world the Great Depression. Hardly anyone remembers the half century of remarkable, even heroic achievements that preceded it. Consider his curriculum vitae. Orphaned at 8, he put himself through college. He was in the first graduating class from Stanford University, and became a successful mining engineer in the western United States. He then went off to Australia, where he more or less started the mining industry in western Australia, still one of the most productive regions in the world, and eventually ended up in London, where he became a vastly wealthy and influential pillar of the business community. Such was his nature that, at the outbreak of the First World War, he was invited to join the British cabinet, a signal honor to say the least, for an American citizen, but declined and instead took on the job of directing famine relief throughout Europe, an undertaking that he managed with such thoroughness and distinction that it is estimated he saved 10 million lives. By the end of the war, he was one of the most admired and respected men in the world, known everywhere as the great humanitarian. Returning to America, he became a trusted advisor to Woodrow Wilson, then served as Secretary of Commerce under Harding and Coolidge, where he oversaw a 58% rise in American exports in 8 years. When he ran for president in 1928, he was elected in a record landslide. In March 1929, he was inaugurated. 7 months later, Wall Street crashed and the economy went into freefall. Contrary to common belief, Hoover responded at once. He spent more money on public works and unemployment relief than all his predecessors combined, provided $500 million in assistance to troubled banks, even donated his own salary to charity. But he lacked the common touch and alienated the electorate by insisting repeatedly that recovery was just around the corner. In 1932, he was defeated as resoundingly as he had been elected 4 years before, and has since been remembered ever since as an abject failure. Still, at least he is remembered for something, which is more than can be said for many of our chief executives. Of the 41 men who have risen to the office of president, at least half served with such lack of eminence as to be almost totally forgotten now, which I think is deserving of the warmest approbation. To be president of the United States and not accomplish anything is, after all, a kind of accomplishment in itself. By almost universal agreement, the most vague and ineffectual of all our leaders was Millard Fillmore, who succeeded to the office in 1850 upon the death of Zachary Taylor, and spent the next 3 years demonstrating how the country would have been run if they had just propped Taylor up in a chair with cushions. However, Fillmore has become so celebrated for his obscurity that he is no longer actually obscure, which rather disqualifies him from serious consideration. Far more noteworthy to my mind is the great Chester A. Arthur, who was sworn in as president in 1881, posed for an official photograph, and then, as far as I can make out, was never heard from again. If Arthur's goal in life was to grow rather splendid facial hair and leave plenty of room in the history books for the achievements of other men, then his presidency can be ranked a sterling success. Also admirable in their way were Ruther B. Hayes, who was president from 1877 to 1881, and whose principal devotions were the advocacy of hard money and the repeal of the Bland-Allison Act, preoccupations so pointless and abstruse that no one can remember now what they were, and Franklin Pierce, whose term of office from 1853 to 1857 was an interlude of indistinction between two longer periods of anonymity. He spent virtually the whole of his incumbency helplessly intoxicated, prompting the affectionate slogan, "Franklin Pierce, the hero of many a well-fought bottle." My favorites, however, are the two presidents Harrison. The first was William Henry Harrison, who heroically refused to don an overcoat for his inaugural ceremony in 1841, consequently caught pneumonia, and with engaging swiftness expired. He was president for just 30 days, nearly all of it spent unconscious. 40 years later, his grandson, Benjamin Harrison, was elected president and succeeded in the challenging ambition of achieving as little in 4 years as his grandfather had in a month. As far as I'm concerned, all these men deserve public holidays of their own. So you may conceive my dismay at news that moves are afoot in Congress to abolish President's Day and return to observing Lincoln's and Washington's birthdays separately, on the grounds that Lincoln and Washington were truly great men and, moreover, didn't pee out the window. Can you believe that? Some people have no sense of history. Speaking of history, where will you fall in the history of voting? Speaking of voting, candidates are always very interested in what their constituents want. Okay, you can stop laughing now. At the very least, they pay attention to what voters want. Even voters in the most remote areas can have a huge impact on which candidate gets into office. No comments, please. Anyway, let's hear about a moment a group of voters in Philadelphia suburbs had one election season. From the book, I Need a Lifeguard Everywhere But the Pool, written by Lisa Scottolini and Francesca Saratella, published in 2017, Lisa's chapter, "If You're a Woman, They Only Want One Thing." We're having a moment this election season. By we, I'm talking about women in the Philadelphia suburbs, like me. I live in the Philadelphia suburbs. In fact, it's all about me. These days, you cannot turn on a TV channel, listen to the radio, or read an article without hearing about whether one of the political candidates will get the vote of the woman in the Philadelphia suburbs. Me! I don't know how this started, but probably with political pundit Chris Matthews, who's from the Philadelphia suburbs, and Jake Tapper, who's also from the Philadelphia suburbs, and Michael Smirkonish, who's not only from the Philadelphia suburbs, but still lives in the Philadelphia suburbs. Okay, full disclosure, Smirkonish once had his book club read my latest book, and he also nicknamed me Hotalini. That's right, hot. It was a long time ago, okay? I cleaned up well back then, when I actually cleaned up. Anyway, with the spotlight being on women in the Philadelphia suburbs, the candidates and their celebrity surrogates visit here all the time. It's swinging to be in a swing state. And the political commercials are nonstop. Some people don't like them, but I do, especially since my other choice is a catheter commercial. Plus, my phone is ringing off the hook. I keep hoping it's Bradley Cooper, but it's not. He has my cell phone and my heart. To stay on point, the calls come on my landline, which is a giveaway for robocallers and other calls that I ignore, but not in election season. Pollsters are calling to ask questions about the election, and I take the call. I answer every question they have. I yap and yap about my views. In the beginning of our phone conversation, they love talking to me. They're so used to being abused that they keep asking me questions, and I keep answering. Then they can't shut me up. They try to say goodbye, but I won't let them. I talk and talk and talk. In the end, they hang up on me. I make them sorry they ever called a woman from the Philadelphia suburbs. I turn the table. The kitchen table. Why do I do this? Because I might never get another chance. Because it's taken too damn long for anybody to care what suburban women think, whether they live in the Philadelphia, Cleveland, New York, Los Angeles, Boston, Atlanta, Dallas, or any other suburb. Because we've heard ourselves called soccer moms, hockey moms, dance moms, and every other kind of mom, whether our kids play any sport or whether we're moms at all. Because we're not considered, much less considered individuals. We've heard ourselves talked about, but never talked to, and more importantly, listened to. We're women, constituting over half of the population of the United States, and we should count more than we have in the past. Because even though we're marketed to for purchases from backpacks to eyeliner, boob jobs to liquor, we're rarely asked what we think. And when we answer, nobody listens. And if they listen, nothing changes. So I hope that women in whichever suburbs, as well as women in the cities or exurbs, will finally get some attention. I hope that people will finally care about what we think, even if they never have before in our lifetime. Maybe we shouldn't be picky. We're used to being wanted for our bodies. It's an improvement to be wanted for our votes. Plus, you have to start somewhere. It's almost a century after we got the vote, and they just realized we have one. Better late than never. So whichever political candidate you support, I encourage you to vote, especially if you have ovaries, or used to. I believe I still have ovaries, but I'm dead below the waist. They're there, like my appendix. Cute, but extra weight. I can't wait to vote, and I'm enthusiastic about my candidate. I hope you feel the same way about yours. But if you don't, I hope you feel enthusiastic about voting, because it matters now more than ever. Our great country stands strong, as one of the world's most stable democracies, founded on wonderful ideals and freedoms for each and every one of us. So show whoever's listening, even momentarily, that women have enormous political power, market power, and personal power. It's time for them to hear us roar. It's time for them to hear us at all. Now, doesn't that just get you eager for the election season, my dear listeners? To hear the next political podcast as soon as it's uploaded? To feel the rush of casting your ballot and becoming part of voting history? Just make sure that if you do get a little overly zealous during the election season, you don't let that zeal affect your personal relationships. How can you avoid that? I'm glad you asked. Francesca Saratella happens to have very sound advice. Also from the book, I Need a Lifeguard Everywhere But the Pool, Francesca's chapter, Political Partisan Seeks Same. I've become obsessed with this election. I won't tell you whom I'm supporting. Just assume I agree with you so you can get through reading this. I stay up late reading every new article and poll. My Twitter timeline reads like the water cooler at every major newspaper and not so major online rag. I listen to 5 different political podcasts on rotation, and I watch more cable news than your grandma. There's only one area of my life to get the political filter. I want a partisan boyfriend. If any guy wants to date me before November 8th, we need to agree about this election. I'm not advocating for this. I'm merely confessing to it. To those in an inter-party relationship, I tip my hat to you. You have your priorities straight. Well, one of you does. In general, I don't think ill of the opponent's supporters. Everyone has different needs, perspectives, and opinions, and I respect their views. I'm just not taking my clothes off for that view. Until November 9th, I'm friend-zoning the other team. I need a break from the constant conscientiousness, and it's so much easier if we're on the same page. Plus, what's more attractive than a man who already admits you're right? We can exchange eye rolls over the slanted coverage and share a laugh over all the same memes. Forget Netflix. I want to CNN and chill. We'll watch the debates cuddled under a cozy blanket, and he'll hold me during the scary parts. Then, when it's over, the mood will be set, either by the thrill of victory or the frisson of the impending apocalypse. And my partisan boyfriend won't criticize that hyperbole, because he'll be right there with me. True love is being heavily biased in your partner's favor. I'm not the only one who feels this way. Many dating apps have offered photo filters and stickers to let you announce your fierce partisanship, but in a fun way. My friends who don't want to turn their selfies into campaign propaganda instead mention their affiliation in their bios. I also have friends who subsequently took it out of their bios because they received too many hateful trolling messages from fans of the other candidate. Women on dating apps expect to be harassed with lewd sexual come-ons, but partisan insults? Please, have some decency. Just as we may irrationally apply bad traits to those who disagree with us, I irrationally project good qualities onto those who share my views. I find myself Googling my favorite pundits and reporters' marital status. Just my luck, my political crushes are gay or married. All the best pundits are taken. Actually, one is single, and I hope he has noticed my pointed liking of all of his tweets. Recently, one of my friends helped host a fundraiser for our candidate. I went to support the cause and take advantage of the target-rich environment for finding the ideologue of my dreams. I dressed as hot as is acceptable for the politically conscious. I aspired to look like Scandal's Olivia Pope during sweeps week. Through my political beer goggles, all the men were attractive. They seemed smarter, more sensitive, and thoughtful than most. I knew they respected me and my opinions, and I appreciated that. What better foundation for a relationship than shared goals and worldviews? And wow, donating to a political campaign? That showed they cared about others and had disposable income. I was impressed, and I hadn't even talked to one yet. Knowing we had at least one thing in common, I was more outgoing. I struck up a conversation with a well-dressed, sophisticated man standing by the cheese plate. We got to talking about campaign strategy. And at some point, through my fog of pre-approval, I noticed he was lecturing me. He seemed to think he knew exactly what our candidate should do. He asked me only rhetorical questions to set up his next point, and he didn't ask my opinion at all. I guess he thought he didn't have to. I practiced my debate podium smile as he speechified, but I was thinking he didn't look sophisticated as much as he looked too old for me. He seemed more capable of pedantry than insight. I wondered if he was ever going to stop talking. Where's a good moderator when you need him? Eventually, I escaped to the bar. Election day can't come soon enough. And on that note, I leave you with a few prophetic quotes. First, from actor and humorist Will Rogers, found on liveabout.com. Everything is changing. People are taking their comedians seriously and the politicians as a joke. And from wiseoldsayings.com, Winston Churchill's recommendation for anyone interested in becoming a politician one day. A politician needs the ability to foretell what is going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, and next year, and to have the ability afterwards to explain why it didn't happen. Insert your own jokes there, folks. And that's all the time we have for today's episode of That's a Laugh. Thank you for joining me today. We hope you enjoyed the show and will listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. One more time, that's ncreadingservice.org. And remember, you can now listen to NCRS on Amazon Echo. Simply say, Alexa, tune in NC Reading Service, and you will hear our broadcasts instantly. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any amusing quotes or anecdotes you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number, one more time, is 919-832-5138.